Hello. Good afternoon. It's 5 o'clock. 1700 hours. All right. Let's get started with this mouthful of a talk. Essential truths everyone should know about performance in a large managed code base. That is a mouthful. I was able to state it without tripping up too much there. My name is Dustin Campbell. I'm a senior program manager on the managed languages team. I'm actually accountable for the editing experiences in C# and Visual Basic within Visual Studio. For the last 3 years, I've been working primarily on a project called Roslyn. How many people here have heard of that project? Cool. I'm not going to give you a ship date if that's what you're here for. Okay. We can talk later about that. But I've been primarily focused on that, and as we've been kind of shifting into getting Roslyn into more of an end game, there's your hint on the ship dates if you're looking for that, but getting it more into an end game, we've also, our team has taken back the existing C# and Visual Basic editing experiences and the existing C# and Visual Basic compilers, and so right now my team is responsible for everything you're going to see in Visual Studio 2013 for C# and Visual Basic, at least accountable for that, and also for the stuff coming in the future. Now, I'm not the subject matter expert on performance, okay? I'm going to tell you right now, if you had illusions about me being kind of a performance genius, you might be, you know, disappointed. I'm actually, this talk was developed by one of our principal developers named Paul Harrington, who's a personal hero of mine, somebody that I work together with on a daily basis, and I've worked with on performance investigations. And so I would look at Paul as kind of the subject matter expert. He's been a performance investigation specialist, really, on Visual Studio for, the past decade, I think. And so a lot of sort of the richness and wisdom of that's in this talk comes from him. So if you ever get an opportunity to see him speak or to talk with him or engage with him at all, I would highly recommend you do so. He's really an awesome guy. So this is about performance in a large managed code base, as it says. That code base that we're going to look at, we're going to kind of use as a case study in this talk, is in fact Roslyn. Roslyn is about 80 projects of C# and Visual Basic code, about 2 million lines of code, and it has some very aggressive performance goals. And so we're going to look at some of what we've done in Project Roslyn to try and achieve the best performance we can. First, we're going to cover some basics, some basic kind of performance collection sorts of basics, kind of set the playing field level for everyone as far as what I mean when I talk about performance testing and measurement. Then we're going to look at the Roslyn case study, and your key takeaways from this should, in fact, as according to the title, be three essential truths, and we'll look at those as we come to them. So let's get started. Just as a level set, how many people here have participated in some sort of performance investigation, maybe with a customer or on your team? Most people put their hands up. That's great. So then a lot of you may be familiar with this, okay, what I call the sad reality approach to performance. The user says, they contact you and says it's too slow. And so you ask a bunch of questions like, what are you doing? Are you the only one seeing this? Is it just you, or does everyone else see this? What's your OS? What's your workload like? What hardware are you running on? And then based on the answers to those questions, you make an educated guess as to what the cause of the problem might be. Okay, you kind of go back to the product group and maybe find a guru on your team and he says, hey, try this. Set this one registry setting or, make this little tweak in the configuration. That'll do it, right? And the user comes back, no, it's still too slow. And this goes on for a while. This becomes a cycle. I don't know if anybody's familiar with this, but I'm certainly familiar with this sort of cycle where you kind of come back, ask some more questions, try and probe and find out what might the cause be and try and fix it without really understanding what the current behavior of the product is on their system. And so finally you get to the dreaded option. You upgrade the users, you say, your hardware is just too slow to run my application, right? You've just thrown in the towel at this point. So it's time to go get more RAM, get that SSD you've been dreaming about, and upgrade your hardware. And of course, it's too slow still. Nope, that doesn't work. And so then what happens eventually, the user gets bored. Find something else to do. You get bored. Maybe stop answering their emails. Start evading because you can't figure out what's wrong and you don't really have a process in place to approach this performance problem, right? And the real sad reality part of this is that nobody's satisfied. The customer's not satisfied. You're not satisfied. Everybody kind of feels bad about the situation, but you just sort of let it go. Now, we believe there's a better approach. Okay, and this is the approach that we take within developer division at Microsoft with Visual Studio. And so first we assign performance goals to key user scenarios. So finding out what those user scenarios are we care about and assign some goals to them. Then we write tests, automated tests, to measure those performance goals to see whether they're meeting or not. And we need to write automated tests because I can't sit in front of a computer with a stopwatch and, you know, be accurate every time. I'll also start influencing the results if I think it's something I want to see. So we want to make sure that they're automated. And then we use those automated tests, the results of those tests. If the performance goals aren't meeting according to those tests, then we're going to use that to guide performance investigations, modifications to the product by what I call the scientific method. Okay. So most people here should be familiar with the scientific method. If you spent any time in school, you should be familiar with some form of the scientific method. I mean, first you formulate a question, and then from that you define a hypothesis, right? And make a prediction about that hypothesis in an experiment. You design the experiment, run a control group, run a candidate group, and analyze the results, and determine whether your hypothesis became true and can be accepted, or whether it's rejected and you need to go back to the drawing board. All right. Well, the scientific method of performance is a little bit different. It's similar, but it's slightly different. Really, the key difference is that you don't know what's slow yet, right? You don't really know what the problem is at this point. You just know that it's slow, but you don't know what it is. So at this point, you could guess, but that's just the sad reality, right? You don't want to get to guessing. You want to have some better grounding in what the current behavior of the product is before you can start making guesses at what and formulating hypotheses. So, we measure the product. We measure the current behavior. And this might actually be on a product that's in flight. As we work on Visual Studio, we're constantly measuring our current behavior, the current performance of the product. And that's happening as the product is yet unfinished, right? And so, but we want to know what the current behavior is at any moment. We actually do this pretty regularly. We run our tests pretty regularly to make sure that we can also track performance that creeps in over time. Right, you get those kind of performance creep where things just start slowly going up over weeks and months, and you don't notice it. There's not really a spike. And so being able to track performance for kind of those spikes when somebody checks in and things just are on the floor and super slow, and you also want to track performance to measure performance in an ongoing way. So we measure the current behavior. Now, besides giving us clues as to where the bottlenecks might be, that kind of gives us two things, right? First, it helps us to establish an environment. And what I mean by that is to define a set of environmental constants, like the hardware we're going to run our tests on, the number of cores, the OS, right? There might, in fact, be multiple sets of environmental constants, like, you know, a set for a low-end machine that might be single or dual proc, or a very, very high-end machine with all the really cool hardware and gadgets, right? And then, in measuring the current behavior, we're going to use profilers, a profiler tool, to gather some baseline data that we'll use throughout the rest of this method. Who here is familiar with a profiler? Everybody? Okay, good. Hope so. So once we have that baseline data, we use this profiler to get our data. Profilers are very, very good at, you know, figuring out where you're spending time, right? Not just elapsed time, but also disk I/O and network I/O and memory allocation. And so we use that baseline data and all that information. And at this point, we need to analyze those bottlenecks. And so a human needs to come in and analyze and make some decisions, make some guesses, form a hypothesis, right? Looking at the data to determine where the real bottlenecks are, where kind of the juicy fruit are that can be harvested, right? And so you formulate a hypothesis about where the bottleneck is. Aha, the bottleneck is here. And then you define an experiment. Essentially, you decide upon some modification to the product to try and reduce, either substantially reduce or completely remove that bottleneck. Okay. Then you conduct the experiment by making the modification, and we compare the results, right? So our baseline data that we gathered in the first step We can compare. That's kind of our control group, right? And then once we've modified the code, we gather data again. We measure again, and that's our experimental or our candidate group. Then finally, we can analyze the results at the end and either accept or reject the modification. Now, it's very important, as I said, that these tests are automated so that no human can interfere with the results. I'm a human being, right? And I know you guys are human beings. And some of you may relate to this. I sometimes, when I'm trying to make a performance fix or something that I think is going to improve performance, I kind of want it to be the hero fix, the one that really solves all the performance and makes everybody really happy. And more often than not, that's not the case, right? Sometimes these are very incremental, and it's going to take sustained effort of changes in order to really improve performance. And also, there, in many cases, it won't work. You'll be rejecting your hypothesis. What you thought was the bottleneck, in fact, wasn't the bottleneck. Maybe you're just, as we say at Microsoft, we have a saying where we call it peeling the onion, where you just take one peel off the onion, and nope, there's more work underneath that's actually making things slow. But when that hypothesis is proven false, it often leads to important information to form your next hypothesis. Okay? So that's the scientific method of performance. And what this leads us to is our first essential truth. Okay? And the first essential truth is that profiles don't lie. Okay? You can speculate and hypothesize all you want, but if you're not measuring, you're just guessing. Okay? And the reason I like to use profilers is because, I mean, profilers are very good at really pointing the finger right at where the problem is. Okay? If your problem is CPU bound, it's going to point the finger right at it. Right? If your bottleneck is disk I/O, well, your CPU is going to be sitting there with cycles free, and your disk is going to be saturated. Okay? And so, once again, if we're not looking at the profiles, we're just guessing, and that's that sad reality. Right? And I've just seen too many novice and really and expert teams get caught up in that trap of just guessing, you know, hypothesizing without having that good empirical scientific data. And also, essential truth number two. So we get these right up front, right? Get the truths right up front. Good tools make all the difference. And the tool of choice for me and for us on the Roslyn team is a tool called, a profiler called PerfView. PerfView is freely available. You can download it. It's built by one of the partner developers on the CLR named Vance Morrison, who's a very, very, very smart guy. If you ever get a chance to talk with him, he makes me feel sometimes very small, and he didn't intend to make me feel small. He's just very, 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 very intelligent. And he's built this tool that we find it really just to be the most, one of the best tools for getting all of the sorts of data. Let me flip over to my laptop. I'm going to do a quick, just kind of show you PerfView. This is not meant to be this talk is not to be meant to be a PerfView demo, really, or a lot of PerfView demos. I want to talk about performance, but I want to show you PerfView to give you a sense of how powerful this tool. How many people actually have seen PerfView before? Okay, not a lot of you. Great. This would be information for you then. All right, so I'm just going to bring it up. So this is PerfView. I do want to point out that it is particularly what I would call developer art, the user interface. It's not exactly, this is not going on the Windows Store at any time soon. It has extensive F1 help. So if you're trying to get involved in using the tool or trying to get to the start of it, there's documentation everywhere. It almost becomes distracting at times. But if I press F1, this gives me how to get started. There are actually over here there are links to tutorial videos that will take you to the site where Vance Morrison actually narrates screencasts of how to use the tool. And there's F1 help literally everywhere on every option. PerfView is actually, it's built on a technology called ETW, Event Tracing for Windows. Just kind of a quick show of hands on how many have actually spent any time with that. Okay. So this is actually something that was built into Windows, I believe, as early as Vista. It might have been a server. Was the earliest point it was into the Windows product. But what it is a tracing system that's actually built from kernel all the way up to user mode. And a lot of the Windows subsystems are instrumented with ETW, with events for ETW. And it's kind of now the technology that all of the performance and profiling, or most of the performance and profiling tools at Microsoft are kind of converging around. One of the big benefits of it, I find is that it does machine-wide profiles. So it's actually profiling all processes and bringing in events and collecting events. So for Perfview. And so this is especially useful if you're setting up your automated testing, your environments, and there's some other process on the machine that's actually making your application slow. Maybe it's Patch Tuesday and it's Windows Update that's happening. Perfview, you'll see that in Perfview, right? Because it's doing a machine-wide trace. And so let me just kind of, actually, let's go ahead and collect something. So I'm gonna say collect right here. And this is going to give us a dialogue. Again, not the most inviting user interface, especially when I drop down here. But you can see the level of detail that you can go to. There's a lot of information here. Again, you can play with this on your own and kind of watch some of the tutorials and see more how to use this. Again, it's not a Perfview demo per se. But I'm going to just start the collection. Let me pop out of here. And I'm going to start up Visual Studio. All right, this is Visual Studio 2012. I'm going to open a solution of a demo I have for a different talk. And that causes the Test Explorer to come up and find some tests. And then we're going to go over here. Now, all this time it's been collecting, I'm going to stop the collection. And now Perfview is going to start working on processing those events that have come in. And as soon as it's ready, there we go. We have a whole series of reports to kind of look at and see the information that's coming from Perfview. So, for example, I can look at, this is just a basic kind of information about the trace and, you know, the number of processors on this machine and the amount of RAM. Obviously, this is a kind of a beefy laptop. And then there are all these other kind of stacks, stack views across the CPU, disk I/O, GC heap, all sorts of valuable information. So, I'm going to bring up a CPU stacks, and again, this was machine-wide, right? So you see all the processes represented here. I'm going to actually look at all procs, and this will give us all the top-running call stacks across the machine while we're collecting. So let's just click on the CLR here, and you can start to drill in and start seeing some of the information that's available to you. Now, I'm running with NGen symbols right now, so we can't go too far, but we can at least start drilling in and seeing some of the things coming up from Visual Studio, right? There's the extensibility hosting in Visual Studio, which uses MEF, the Managed Extensibility Framework. And you can see right there's the test window, actually using MEF to pull in what I had in that project was the XUnit test runner, right? So just kind of want to demonstrate just very quickly, you know, sort of the power of Perfview and how much you can get out of it. It really provides a ton of information. It's kind of ridiculous. It is actually ridiculous. It's laugh-worthy. It's so powerful. All right, and it really does. One thing I really like about Perfview is that it does a really great job of pulling together both the collection and the analysis of ETW traces. So once you've collected a trace, you can go and you can pass that around and you can pull it up in Perfview and analyze it later. And so it's very useful. We have tools at Microsoft, in fact, that will collect ETW traces on users' machines so that we can perform some deeper analysis if a customer is having problems. Okay. All right. There's the demo. Okay. So let's talk about Roslyn. Again, there are a handful of people, actually about half of you, I think, that had kind of said you'd heard of the Roslyn project. And so let's kind of just drill in. Roslyn. Roslyn used to be called Compiler as a Service. I've actually started to push away from that name because as a service means something different these days. Because Roslyn is not really about building some cloud-enabled compiler. We're not compiling your code in the cloud or anything like that. Instead, what it really means is building. We're rebuilding the Visual Basic and C# compilers and the Visual Studio integration for C# and Visual Basic, called the language services up there, in managed code in C# and Visual Basic, right? So, and that's from soup to nuts, from the compilers all the way up to IntelliSense. The as a service part comes in, and why we called it compiler as a service is because compilers typically are black boxes. Right? They're really kind of a pure function if you think of them. You put in inputs, and you should always get, you know, the same output, the same generated code out of them. But all of the work that it does in between to figure that out, building up, you know, all the analysis that it does over the source code and over the metadata, just gets thrown away, right? And so we want to build public API surface on that, so that tool vendors, extension writers can access that information and build build a really rich ecosystem of tooling around C Sharp and Visual Basic. In addition, Roslyn is working on, partly because we have these compiler APIs and we're building this richness in, we're introducing new features into the product and new experiences with Roslyn into the C Sharp and Visual Basic editing experiences. This is a really key goal of Roslyn, is to kind of bring kind of a next generation IDE experience to Visual Studio. And so introducing things like, you know, new code refactorings, because we haven't shipped one since Visual Studio 2005 in C Sharp. Code issue detection, code smells, and those sorts of things. Also, the C Sharp interactive window, which many people are familiar with when hearing about Project Roslyn, because Anders has demoed that a couple of times, I believe, at PDCs and Builds Past. So these are some of the experiences that we're working for in Roslyn. If you want to read all about it, you can go to mstn.com/roslyn and read all about it. Okay. But I want to talk about performance and what we think about with performance on Roslyn. So our key performance scenario is really we break into two parts. There's compiler throughput, okay, and that's just what it sounds like. It's the batch compile, the full kind of benchmark of compilation. How fast can we build your C-sharp or Visual Basic solutions, right? So what we do is we build very, very large projects. In fact, today, Roslyn can build the entire DevDiv source tree of C-sharp and Visual Basic, which is large. There's a lot of code there. We can build that entire source tree, and we'll use that and compare that benchmark with the old compilers, which is a challenge. The old compilers are written in native C++. They've been hand-optimized for years, and so it's a challenge to get there. One of the cool things about Roslyn is that, and you'll see as we get deeper into this, especially in the IDE, is that we can take advantage of things that would be very difficult to retrofit onto the native compilers today, things like, you know, compiling method bodies in parallel, for example, would be very difficult to put on the native compiler. And so today, depending on your environment, the Roslyn compilers are faster than the native C-sharp and VB compilers, the old ones. Depending, again, on your environment. If you're on that single or dual proc machine, that might not be the case, but as you increase your number of cores, Roslyn starts to edge to win. Now, the other chunk of these are the IDE responsiveness tests. And these are the ones that I think are really interesting. Because when we get this wrong, you guys really feel it, right? And we're talking about when you press a key in the editor and nothing happens, right? Nothing comes on the screen. There's no keyboard echo on the screen. That's when you guys send me hate mail. You hate me personally for this, because I said I was responsible, right? And so the IDE responsiveness, we actually look at several different scenarios. Things like typing in IntelliSense, right? So that's your basic keyboard echo, right? Making sure that when I press a key, it appears on the screen very quickly. When there's an IDE experience like C Sharp or Visual Basic, there's a lot of features that can get in the way of that happening, right? A lot of features that are trying to perform some computation and provide some help to the user. Things like the completion list, signature help that pops up, automatic brace completion for Visual Studio 2013, formatting, all sorts of things that happen. Now, and so we want those to be kind of in the immediate class of responsiveness. We want to make those within the 50 to sub 100, sub 50 millisecond time frame. And that's the goal we associate. These kind of break down nicely into kind of some responsiveness categories. The second one, navigation and search. These are things that we think, you know, this could be a second or 2 seconds. Doesn't have to be that near immediate response that you need from IntelliSense while you're typing. But things like go to definition or find all references, or even, you know, showing the generate method stub smart tag, for example, falls under this category. And then there are scenarios that just take a long time. They're very long running. Things like diagnostics, like, you know, finding all the syntax errors, finding all of the to-do comments across your entire solution. Those are long running, and as a user, you're okay with them taking a little bit longer. They don't need to be there immediately because it takes you some time to even get over to the window to see what's there. All right. And so we kind of break these into these scenarios, and we give them these goals based on responsiveness classes. Okay. Now, the performance characteristics of Roslyn, for compilation, it's probably pretty obvious, right? We're gonna have that compiler pipeline where we're gonna bring in source code and metadata. We're gonna read all that in, parse it, We're going to build up some in-memory data structures. We parse the source code into what we call syntax trees. And then we perform the act of binding, which is kind of the semantic analysis where we build semantic models around those trees, really kind of reasoning over those data structures. Then we emit. We write out that binary, the IL and the metadata. And then we let it all go. Okay. So really, we kind of do, for compilation, we just do all the work necessary, and then we throw it all away. That's kind of the characteristic of the compiler. Again, on the IDE side, things are a little bit more interesting. All right, so for IntelliSense, we use the same in-memory data structures that come from the compiler that we use during compilation, but we only use pieces of them. Right? So if I'm typing in a single line comment right in the middle of a method body, I'm not going to use the entire tree or even realize the entire tree or the rest of the files necessarily to show some form of IntelliSense. Then the data set that IntelliSense might use is mostly unchanging. Again, go back to thinking about typing in a large file in a method body. Most of the world around that method body is not changing. The method body itself is changing, but the references, the metadata references, they're not changing. The rest of the source files in the project, other projects that reference this or this one references, they're not changing, right? And so what we end up in in the IDE, we tend to build things up incrementally, right? So Roslyn has a model of building up immutable data structures. These in-memory data structures are immutable. And when we make changes, because those changes are very small, we don't realize the entire snapshot. Instead, we incrementally produce new snapshots on top of the old one, right, with those changes. Now, another characteristic of the IDE is that there are more queries than there are updates, right? So when I press a character in the editor, that's going to cause an update to the models, right, producing a new incremental snapshot. But there are far more queries that are going to happen. For example, the colorizer is going to come in and decide, oh, do I need to colorize something? And so it's going to ask some questions of that snapshot that's already there. IntelliSense is going to decide whether it needs to come up. Does it need an error squiggle? There's a lot of features that come in and make those queries. So that's another characteristic, is that because we have this immutability and we want to make these updates incrementally, those happen much slower than the actual questions. So we want to make sure the questions are fast. Getting answers to those questions are particularly fast. Another characteristic is that we can speculatively do a lot of the work, especially for the long-running things like the semantic analysis to show an error squiggle. For example, we can do that asynchronously in the background. We use async tasks from the .NET framework to do that. And when we use these, one of the things that we have to be very careful of is now in the IDE we become managers of tasks, right? We need to do proper management of those tasks. And often that means making sure that we're never blocking on that asynchronous work on the UI thread, right? If we can help it. There are cases where we can't help it. And it comes back to IntelliSense. IntelliSense is kind of a finicky feature where when I press the first identifier character of a word, we want to start computing IntelliSense asynchronously. And as you type, that asynchronous computation is still going on. But as soon as you hit a commit character, a dot or an open parenthesis or a space or something where it needs to say spit the entire identifier, if you've only written a partial identifier, we need to wait until the computation is done so we can figure out which identifier to spit, right? We need to make sure we insert the right text into the editor. So that's a place where we have to block, and we have to tune around that behavior. All right. So as we've been working on performance in Roslyn, and I'm going to kind of give it a little apology. For those of you that have played with Roslyn, the last community technology preview we put out was in September. And I would say it was about September that we really started to get very, very serious about performance investigation. We needed to get certain things kind of done before we could do that. And we were doing performance investigation, but we really doubled down on it in September. So your experiences may not be as fast as they are today. But as we've started to really deeply investigate since September, we have some observations. First of all, we're rarely CPU bound, meaning very rarely are we actually wrapped up in the work of doing a computation. More often, we might be I/O bound, right? Because we need to read in source code, we need to read in metadata, or actually emit to disk. But most of our CPU time, our delays on the UI thread, are actually spent in the garbage collector. Okay, and I can read your minds right now. You're thinking to yourselves, oh no, the garbage collector is slow. Why in the world did I pick this .NET thing in the first place? Right? It's okay. The garbage collector is not actually true. The garbage collector is incredibly efficient. The problem isn't in the garbage collector's efficiency. The problem is that we're allocating like crazy, right? So the garbage collector has so much work to do that it's forced to block the UI thread to get that work done so they can get memory down to a meaningful baseline, right? And so CPU time spent in the garbage collector actually indicates an allocation bottleneck, right? And so allocations matter. And a lot of the work we've done in the past 6 months to reduce to improve performance has been to reduce our allocations using that scientific method that I talked about a little bit ago. We've been using that and kind of incrementally improving things. And you would be amazed. The numbers that we've seen, we've dropped literally in tests where you're typing for a minute, we've dropped as much as like 6 gigabytes of memory allocation that can occur. It's amazing how much can happen when it's just unbounded and unchecked. Especially in something like Roslyn, where there is so much data, and it scales linearly to the size of your solution. So when you're trying to type in a large solution, you find yourself allocating a lot of memory. So reducing allocations is really, really easy with Perfview. Okay, at that level. In fact, it's kind of like the sort of thing where Paul has told me, he's like, I get to do this. This is ridiculous that they pay me to do this job. I mean, because Perfview, you just fire it up and it says, oh, the bottleneck is right here. He says, okay, well, let me go look at that code and fix that bottleneck and move on to the next thing, right? And through some sustained work, you can make those sorts of changes and just kind of reduce bottlenecks like that, allocation bottlenecks, and improve performance. But really, it's kind of the bigger changes where you take a step back, look at data structures, decide whether they're actually needed, right? You want to try and solve the problem, in this case, of not allocating anything at all, right? So are the data structures actually needed? Are all the fields in those data structures needed? Could they be lazy, where you have placeholder data that's computed on demand? Perhaps you take a look, another step back, and you see that two systems use very similar data, and they could share that data instead of both of them computing it, right? And so these are cases where you can make kind of bigger wins in the system. And so that brings us to our third and final essential truth, and that is allocations are king. Time spent in the garbage collector will harm responsiveness, okay? And so I have kind of a memory model up there that we use to kind of understand sort of garbage collection delays. Really, the average delay of a garbage collection is essentially it's your allocation rate. It's the product of your allocation rate and the size of the GC managed heap. And you can kind of correlate that with, you know, your allocation rate is kind of how much you're allocating is affecting how many times the garbage collector is going to run, how many garbage collections are induced. Right, and the size of the managed heap affects how much that collection is going to cost in time to perform. Right, and so this is just kind of some rough math to figure this out. And the corollary is to allocate less. Allocate less often reduces the collection rate. Right, by creating smaller and fewer long-lived objects, we reduce the heap size, and so we can use those two in tandem. To really to address kind of allocation problems, and really Roslyn's problems have been about allocations. Okay, and so let's dig into some of these. Now, this is a controversial slide. I'm going to say it right now. I put this up at TechEd North America, and I made some statements about the slide, and it seemed like everybody I talked to afterwards kind of got the wrong idea. The idea here is that when Perfview or your profiler of choice has pointed a finger at an allocation bottleneck, and you go to that method or that call site where that's happening, these are things that if you see them in your code, they should set off alarm bells and say, is this the allocation? And that's causing a problem. If I'm on a hot path, these things might cause allocations that would induce garbage collections. This is not an indictment or a blacklist of features not to use in your programs. Okay, I want to be really clear. These are wonderful language features that are expressive and allow you to write concise code. However, if they're used in extremely hot paths, that where you're having trouble with allocation, you're having trouble with the garbage collector getting in the way of your responsiveness, then these are things to look for, okay, when you're looking to reduce a bottleneck. Okay, just want to make that clear. Do not go through your source bases and clean all of these out. Okay, I do not want to find out that everybody has flipped back to C# 1.0 and it's all my fault. All right, just really clear. Okay, so let's look at the first one, boxing. How many here, who doesn't know what boxing is? Okay, a couple of people. Boxing in the .NET framework, in the CLR, is when a value type, something that is a something like an integer, something that's allocated on the stack like an integer or a Boolean, needs to be treated like an object. It's passed to something that needs to take object, and so it's going to be then lifted to the GC heap. Okay, where we're going to create an object sort of around it, so we can pass it around. Like you could think of it, if you're remember your C days, you could think of it as taking a reference to that and passing around a pointer in a sense. But in this case, you're actually allocating. And so you can find these very easily in Perfview by using the GC heap alloc view. And so when you bring that up, when you're looking at the GC heap, if you see things like system.int32 or system.boolean, then you know you've got boxing happening. So let me actually flip over and show you what that looks like. Flip back over to my laptop. And in Perfview, I've got a couple of traces that I built before this that from a demo that sort of demonstrates some of these problems. And so we're gonna zoom in again. And I'm going to click on the GC heap alloc stacks. Now, this is from a project that I built up that has all of sort of the flaws that we're going to talk about. And so it's pretty clear in here where there's a problem. And we're just going to look at essential truths. That's the project that I ran. And this is the GC heap. And these are the top allocated objects. And if you look through here, you see system.string at the top. That is unsurprising. When you look at this, you will often see system.string at the top. We'll have more on that later. But down here, the third one down is system.int32. What's that doing there, right? That's a value type. I mean, that should be 4 bytes, but if it's showing up here, that means it's been boxed as an object. And objects, just at their very smallest object, is 12 bytes on the x86, right? Or 24 bytes on x64. So, using that to represent an int32 could present, an inefficiency in memory usage. But it also, because it's lifted to the heap now and allocated on the heap, it's also, potential to induce garbage collections. So let's go ahead and click on this. And here I've got two stacks where this appears to be allocated. You'll see right here, this is what we're going to look at in just a moment. But it points the finger right at the stack where the allocation happens. Right? And in fact, here's another one down here that we'll look at in a little bit as a potential allocation problem. But whenever you see these things on the GC heap, that's an indication of boxing. And sometimes it can be pretty horrible, right? I mean, we see system.boolean boxed all the time. That's 1 bit being represented in 12 bytes. On x86, that seems like possibly there might have been an inefficiency somewhere. All right. Let's flip back over. Now, this is the code that was inducing or allocating all of those system.n32s as boxing. Can someone in here tell me where the boxing is in this code? Yes, sir. He raised his hand before he heard the question. Could someone point out to me if anybody can spot the boxing that's in this code? Yes, sir. String format. Could you be more specific? Great. Perfect. The ID and size are ints, but because there is no overload of string.format that takes string int, the compiler selects an overload that takes string object, and so ID and size get boxed. Okay, it's not horrible, but again, if this is in a tight loop, if this is called very frequently, this could be a problem. Right, so the fix, right, is this: make them strings. Right? Now, of course, this doesn't work if you had complex format specifiers. For example, if you wanted to make it hex or specify the length or the width of the of what was going to be output in the string. But this is a very simple fix. It doesn't work all the time, but it can work for this case, right? On a case-by-case basis, you might reduce some allocations in this case. Don't always do this, okay? I'm just going to keep reiterating this. Do this after measurement, when this has become an allocation bottleneck. If it's not, this is not as clear as just passing ID and size, right? So that's great. We fixed the problem. And then some enterprising developer comes along and says, well, wait a minute. What we're doing here is string concatenation. So shouldn't we really just do this, right? Why are we calling string.format at all? And that's great, but uh-oh, it's actually introduced another allocation, right? The problem is that this compiles to string.compat object, object, object. And there's boxing involved because of the char that's passed as the colon, right? So this is the problem. This gets boxed. And the fix is rather subtle. Just watch very carefully on that char. The fix is to make it a string, right? And then the compiler can successfully grab the concat method that takes string, string, string. Very subtle thing, okay? These are the sorts of things, again, you don't want to spend a lot of time thinking about this when you're writing your code, when you're writing, you know, trying to write your code in an elegant, readable fashion. You don't want to be thinking too much about this. This is why you do measurement. This is why we run those tests. And to find out if we have a bottleneck at all, and if so, where it is. And if it points to this, then maybe we can start doing some tuning. Here's another one. And this one is so subtle, you just have to know it. This is the sort of thing that this actually was responsible for a large amount of allocation in Roslyn, and it was an amazingly simple fix. The problem here is that now in our get hashcode method, we're calling get hashcode on the name field, which is a string, and the color field, which is an enum called color. And the problem is that enum.getHashCode in its implementation in the .NET framework boxes. Compiler's not boxing, but that method itself boxes. And so this is the sort of thing that's, again, it's very, very subtle. You could have pulled it up in Purview, taken a look at it, and you would have wound up finding that the allocation itself happened in enum.getHashCode, looked at Reflector, and now you're kind of at a point where, what do I do, right? The fix here is not hard. The fix, in fact, is, if I can, it's actually to cast to int before calling getHashCode. The problem is that under the hood, you know, that there are methods that the enum uses to get values and get names, and those all take object, right? And it's because there is no kind of super class of enum. The enums themselves don't really, as they're represented in the runtime, kind of descend from enum. And so it becomes a problem where you don't have a virtual method that you can call. And so it winds up being a little goofy the way it's implemented. And so you just have to know it, unfortunately. Again, this wound up for us because we were using enums as keys in dictionaries, right, which was calling the get hash code over and over and over and over and over again, boxing them over and over again, and resulting in some pretty substantial memory allocation. It was something like a gigabyte for this 800 megs or something like that, if I recall. It was amazing. In a performance test that was like a minute-long typing test, right? But still, it was substantial. All right. Next, string manipulation. So string manipulation, as we saw a little bit ago when I was looking at Purview, and you saw that system.string was really on the very top, string manipulation is very often the source of allocations. You know, most applications allocate strings in some form. And you could bet Roslyn has a lot of it, right? Because we're dealing with source code. But in the world of programming, we use strings a lot. We often, for things that might not be as appropriate, use the strings. I mean, we use strings to serialize, you know, int32s and those sorts of things. I mean, we've kind of fallen in love with XML, fallen out of love with XML, things like JSON and REST. All of these are string-based protocols, which, by the way, is perhaps one of the more inefficient ways to move binary data around, but it is the world we live in, right? And so string manipulation is kind of necessary to write serious programs today. But when you find your hot paths, when you find those allocation bottlenecks, look out for concat, split, join, format, substring. Right? These are things that produce a lot of allocations themselves. And even String Builder doesn't help as much as you think. Right? Because at the very end, you're going to call toString, and that's an allocation. Right? The String Builder itself is an allocation. And to do its work, it needs to build up arrays of chars internally and do a lot of other allocation as well. And so, so even String Builder can be problematic. So the first example, I want to apologize for the denseness of this code. This is about as small as we can make it. It is code from the Roslyn code source base, previously from the source base. And it's the work that it's trying to do is it's trying to write a formatted XML.comment string. So it's got a big XML.comment where it's got the triple slashes at the front and then maybe an optional space. And it's trying to grab the text from that and produce some block of text. I think it does this for the metadata as source feature when you go to definition on something that's in metadata and it produces this view of what that class might look like. We also do the XML.comments in there. I think this method runs on that. But there are allocations everywhere. I mean, if you saw this, you know, it smells so bad, you'd walk in, you'd just fall down, right? But let's take a look. So right there is the obvious one, right, where we new up this array every time we come through. And we have to. The compiler dutifully has to new it up every time, even though it's really a constant and we treat it as a constant. But it doesn't know if that array is going to be mutated somewhere else and used in some other method. So it has to create a new array every time of these same things. So obviously, we'd want to get rid of that. Split is an allocation, right? It's going to produce an array of strings at the end. And of course, it's also got internal allocations to kind of mark the starts and ends of things as it does its splitting. Trim start. Actually, trim start happens three times. And these two are in inner loops, these last two, making it even worse. It's like, oh, good. And let me even drill this home even further. Trim start is defined like this, okay, where it takes a params char array parameter, meaning that every time you call it with no parameters, the compiler is newing up a char array of zero elements. Right, so more allocations. Substring down here. So this is really just riddled with allocations. And to fix it, you could walk through each and every one of these, and you could try and reduce these allocations, you know, kind of, you know, one at a time. But really, what needs to happen in something like this is kind of a rewrite. Rewriting that method with some principles in mind. And so, for example, this method is passed a parameter called text. It's passed the string of everything, and that has everything it needs to do its work, right? Because all it's doing is producing a bunch of substrings, right? Substrings are just a start and an end, or, you know, a start and a length, right? And so, and those are just two ints that would be allocated on the stack. And so we can reduce heap allocations. We could reduce this actually to nothing but the string at the very, very end if we worked hard at it. And so this is kind of a flavor of what we rewrote it to look like. And so we have methods like the top one where we find the first index, the index of the first non-white space character, where using a way to walk through the characters in the string and doing it without any allocations, right? Or a method like the trimmed string starts with this prefix, right? Again, using that index of first non-white space char and then searching for the actual prefix. These are the sorts of routines we wrote to really tune that area of the code base and reduce all the allocations. Now, on String Builder, so imagine this is called a lot. And what this is, again, this is something that is very similar to some code we had in our code base. And it's for generating a full type name, where you need to, you know, add arity, you need to add your angle brackets for arity if I'm going to produce a type name. And commas, you need to append commas to it and that sort of thing. And so it uses String Builder to do this, because it was going to be adding and building up some string at the end. The problem is though, you know, there's two allocations here. There's the allocation of the string builder, and then there's the allocation at the end, right? The two string. Not to mention the hidden allocations that happen within string builder to do its work, right? And so, in a case like this, especially with something where you're using this and you want to apply some caching, even a pool of one item is an acceptable cache. And so, we would cache this something like this. Okay, where you now have a method to acquire a builder, you have a method to, you know, and also a method you could use to get and release a builder, for example. And that has one static field. That's our pool. Our pool of one element is a static field. It's marked as thread static because in Roslyn these things might be used within, you know, in concurrent situations, especially within Roslyn. I'm not sure if that's applicable to your code. That's an important note as well. And you would use it. You would use it something like this, where you'd acquire the builder, you'd use it as you did before, and then you'd release it. right? And so you've just got this one builder, string builder, that you're holding around per thread to do that work instead of allocating every single time. Oh, okay. I'm going to get a little rant more on this one. Because, again, I don't want to deter you from writing code like this. This is really elegant code. But you can imagine the developer who wrote this within Roslyn, that he wrote this code, he hit the semicolon at the end, and then he sat back in his chair, and he felt really good. He's like, now I'm a real developer. I have collapsed all of this logic into one line of code. I am uncatchable as a developer, right? The problem is that this is a hot path, right? And this is an allocation bottleneck because there are gobs of hidden allocations here, all right? And I want to walk through them with you just so you understand. Kind of sometimes the cost of using these features can be great. They are very convenient. But again, in those hot paths, you might need to tune them away. So the first change we're going to make to this, I just want to pull out the lambda. It's a delegate, right? It gets that's a method that gets kind of wrapped around in a delegate funk of symbol that goes to bool called predicate, and we pass that in. But the real problem isn't that. The real problem is here, that we capture this local, okay, within that lambda. And that forces the compiler to create a static helper class, a closure class, or a display class. If you look at the reflector, you'll see that you know the C# compiler will generate a new class that has a field for name that takes that captured local. And so it looks something like this. And I'm changing the names to protect the innocent, actually just to keep from the compiler mangled names, but this is effectively what it looks like. You have this lambda class, you have your captured name as a field, and then down there I've also circled where the two allocations would be in your code, because there's the new lambda, the actual new closure class, and then there's the new of the delegate, right? That's another kind of hidden new in your code. But it gets worse. One of the big problems here is that first or default is an extension method on IEnumerable, all right? And that actually costs us in a hidden way. So symbols is a list of symbol. It's a .NET system.collections.generic.list of T. And when we actually call first or default, this now I'm kind of taking some liberties with the code here, but it sort of expands out like this, where where it casts symbols to an IEnumerable symbol, right? And we actually lose some type information there. We no longer know that it's a list of symbol, right? And so then we call enumerable get enumerator from the IEnumerable, and then we use that while loop to kind of walk through. That's not where the problem is. The problem is in that loss of type information, because list of T defines a struct enumerator, and so this causes boxing of that struct enumerator. Right? And so very hidden. And the reason it uses a struct is so that we can for each over lists without a heap allocation for an enumerator. All right? And so the fix is to write it this way. Again, I don't want you to go back to C# 1.0, but that's in fact what we did here. Right? For each over the symbol, if the name matches that was passed in matches the name of the symbol, then we return it. Otherwise, we return null. To me, this is perfectly succinct, perfectly readable, and it's allocation free. Okay, heap allocation free. So, I mean, some of you might be thinking, right, is there an allocation right here? And the answer is no. It expands like this, that the enumeration pattern in C# is actually a pattern similar to link, not quite as robust as link, but similar to link, where if a method declares a getEnumerator method, if a type declares a getEnumerator method and doesn't actually implement IEnumerable, or it doesn't return IEnumerator, but it returns something that has move next and reset and current, it'll use it, right? And so list of T defines a struct one so that it doesn't have a heap allocation for the enumerator. And this allows us to use that and not have a heap allocation. A stack allocation for sure, but not a heap allocation. Right. Async. We use async a lot in Roslyn. And it can be tricky. It can be tricky. And so I want to point out a particular ANI pattern that actually Lucian Wishtyk is going to talk about in one of the async talks. I think it's the async, I can't remember the title, but it's for class library authors. And he's going to talk about some performance issues that you can run into with async. And this is a particular one. So in Roslyn, we are very, very highly asynchronous, right? So you can a thread can ask for a syntax tree, await that syntax tree so that it returns the current thread to the originator, and then will continue when that syntax tree is then available, right? And so this method, get syntax tree async, is the implementation of that method to get the syntax tree. So it's async, it returns a task to syntax tree, and it news up a parser, and then it parses the source code. Now that's the expensive part, right? And then when it's done, it returns the syntax tree that was parsed. And so if this is called a lot, you might be inclined to cache the result. That's good programming, right? That's going to be a performance improvement. And so right here, we introduced a field for the syntax tree. And then we check to see if it's null. And if it's null, then we do the work. And if it's not, we just return the result we had cached the previous time, right? And that should be great, except it's not quite great. And this is the anti-pattern I want to talk about with async. Very subtly, this introduces an allocation. Okay. Because the method is async, and it returns a task, that means that that very bottom return of this dot cached result needs to wrap that in a task. Okay, and so there's a hidden allocation. It needs to wrap that in a task, which calls a task of syntax tree from result. Now the fix is very subtle, I believe. I'm starting to spot it. I'm starting to get a better handle on it. But the fix is not to return the actual result. The fix is to return the task, right? And so we rewrite this to look something like this, where up at the top, there's the async method, in the middle, at the top of the compilation class. But it's now private. Okay, it's the same method that it was in the first place, but it's now private. And then down below, we have our cached result, but that's now become a task of syntax tree instead of just a syntax tree. Then we have our public get syntax tree async that returns a task of syntax tree. It's no longer an async method. See that the async modifier has been removed. And instead, what it does is it returns the cache result. And then down here, I've compressed this code so it's completely unreadable. It uses the null coalescing operator here and assigns cache result. So if cache result is null, it will assign cache result with the result of calling get syntax tree uncached async and return that. And so what it ends up doing is kicking off a task and just returning it and returning the same task every time somebody asks for it. So if that task is a completed state, they get the same result, right? But they get so that's kind of the subtle part. But this is the appropriate way to cache from an async method. Okay, and we ran into this actually a couple of times, and it was surprising to us. So definitely be aware of that anti-pattern. All right. Let's talk a little bit about class versus structs. Actually, let me check my time. I want to make sure I have some time for questions. So just kind of lay of the land here on classes versus structs. These are often points of confusion. Okay, classes they represent in the .NET framework reference types, right? So they're allocated on the heap, and they're cheap to pass around and return because they effectively are just pointers under the hood, right? GC handles that have ultimately become pointers. And the smallest object on x86 is 12 bytes. Okay, so you can imagine that adds up over time. If I have millions of these things, millions of small objects, then that's going to add up to a lot. Now, a struct is allocated on the stack, unless it's boxed. It can also be allocated inline in a class, if it happens to be a field of a class. But just imagining a struct kind of naked, newed up in a method body, it's allocated on the stack. And the interesting thing about structs is that if they get like more than a couple of fields, they have to be copied to the stack. The CLR has to copy them. And the CLR goes through a lot of effort. The JIT goes through a lot of effort to make sure that there's no tearing involved with those copies so that they're performed atomically. And so if you have a lot of fields, if you have a very large struct, it can be more expensive to make that copy. The JIT, if you look, the JIT's very, very generates a lot of machine code to make sure that is a correct copy. And so this can actually result in a CPU bottleneck, right? And so you get kind of a trade-off here. Do I want to use space or time, right? And so you have to kind of just be careful and weigh things. But it is possible for large trucks to create a CPU bottleneck that pops up in your profiles. Another smell to watch out for with structs is watching out for repeated calls to property getters that return a struct, right? Especially if it's going to be something that's going to be a copy. Okay, so you know, small things like 4-byte things like int32, they're not going to be a problem. But we have in our case in Roslyn, we have this struct called a text span that has fields that point back to some text, and it's got an offset and a length into it. And we have many properties that return text spans. And so if in a method body we simply access that text span property all the time, it's resulting in multiple copies all over the place. And the fix there is to actually just hoist that into a local variable, right? Call it once and then use the local variable. Okay, so just to be watching out for. Not, again, don't be a hawk watching this as you're writing your code. Measure and look for these things if you find them. And so here's an example of a struct versus class situation, where I've got a log function, and it's using it takes advantage of the using syntax in C#, where the logger actually has a private log helper class that implements iDisposable, so you can use it in the using statement up there. But if this is called a lot, this can actually result in an allocation bottleneck, because we're allocating a new log helper class every time we come around and log something. And so the naive fix, so there's our allocation. The naive fix would be to make it a struct, right? But that introduces boxing, right? Because we're going to cast it to an iDisposable. We're going to, and then pass it back. We lose that type information, and so the struct has to be then lifted to the heap as an object of type iDisposable, right? And so the real fix in this case, though it's not always possible, is to make our struct public, and then return simply the struct. And now that we haven't lost type information, in that case where it's used in the using statement, the compiler is smart enough to generate efficient code that doesn't produce a box, right, where it uses the address of the log helper struct and constrains it to the iDisposable interface, which is much more efficient than an actual allocation. Okay, so this is just a quick example of something like that. Now, dictionary. This is going to be a bit of a rant, and so I might have to skip a slide or two at the end. Just because I feel that this is an important topic, only because of what we see in Visual Studio codebase. I don't know what you see in your own code bases, but I do know what we see in Visual Studio. And what we see in Visual Studio is that dictionaries are all over the place. And in many cases, and in our experience, it's often overused and abused. I think the reason why is because it's sort of this, what we like to call the associated container of first resort. Right, where it's like, oh, there's the handy collection class that I want to use for just about everything, right? And so they reach for it, even when the problem they're trying to solve isn't actually something that the dictionary is particularly good for, right? At least over some other collection class, right? It is convenient, it's generic, so I can put any type in it; it just works. But it's efficient for most uses, right? But the real problem here is that an empty dictionary, a dictionary with no elements, has 10 fields, which amounts to 48 bytes. Just an empty dictionary, right? It used to be 11 fields and 52 bytes. We got one removed in .NET 4.5. But the real sad thing is that you're allocating all of that memory for this dictionary just to get constant insertion and constant lookup. But the vast majority that we see, at least in our product, are empty. Or have one element, right? And so when you have one element, it seems a little contrived to call get hash code to find it. Just going to go out on a limb and say that. And so what we've seen is just kind of this general abuse where dictionaries are really good at large collections when you need constant time insertion and constant time lookup, but that's just not how they're used. Sometimes they're used really just for the lookup. Right, where you have one building kind of phase where you build up a dictionary and stuff a bunch of data in it, and then it's pristine and it never changes, and you just use it for constant time lookup, right? And there are other data structures you could use for that as well. So it's not really very good at some of these things, and so the real problem with this is that there really isn't a very good alternative today in the .NET framework, not today. Hopefully, there will be something in the future, but. But right now, you kind of have to figure out what you want to do. And often, you know, an array is totally reasonable, right? Log n lookup on a sorted array, you're never going to notice until you get into, you know, upward bounds of, you know, well over single-digit number of elements, I'll tell you. And certainly probably, you know, not until you get, like, more than 100 does it matter, right, in your application. And so just kind of encourage you guys to think about when you're using dictionary, or in Roslyn, when you're using concurrent dictionary, which has even more allocations to allocate arrays of sync objects for every processor on your machine. It allocates, you know, synchronization objects, like the ones you would use in a lock statement, just to be empty, right? Just to kind of pre-allocate a bunch of that. Just encourage you to think about the collections you're going to use. Think about if it's the right choice, especially if you're getting into kind of allocation bottleneck space. And one type to look at if you're interested in kind of getting some inspiration is WPF's MS Utility Frugal Map type. This is actually not public. It's you'd have to use .NET Reflector. Yes, I told you to use .NET Reflector to look at this, or any of the other alternatives out there. But it's much smarter about how much it allocates in order to represent its contents. So if it's empty, it's just null, right? You can't get much better than that. Or if it's one element, then it's that element, right? And as you ask for more elements, it produces new instantiations. It essentially produces new versions of itself, right? There's a version that, you know, is like a map of 3 elements and then a map of 6 elements, right? And then eventually it gets to like just an array. And it's not even sorted, right? But it's fast enough in most cases. But most importantly, it's memory efficient, right? And so that's something to look at for inspiration if you're kind of dealing with the dictionary conundrum. Oh, this is more trivia than anything. But again, this is another case where you might have allocations that are in the .NET framework that you're just not aware of. So this is how read byte is implemented. And it just seems kind of silly to me, right? You just want to get back a byte, so of course it's going to new up an array of one element to get that byte and cast it to the read method that takes a buffer, takes an array of bytes. And of course they made it virtual so we can override it, right? That's great. But yeah, perhaps not the best solution. So this is again, something to kind of watch out for. You can actually fix this by overriding it and specializing your stream class that you're using. Caches. So these are just kind of some bits at the very end to think about. So a cache without a discard policy is a memory leak, right? If you introduce a cache in your system, and usually we do that with dictionaries, right? We build up some dictionary of lookup values, and you don't have a policy for discarding data from that cache, you're simply an unbounded memory leak, right? If you are asking for a sufficient number of values, right? This is actually something you see crop up in functional programming with a memoization pattern, where it'll just be some unbounded map that keeps growing over time as it's returning values. And there's no discard policy on that. And that policy could be, you know, it could be time-based. Maybe it's a day, maybe it's an hour, maybe it's a week, and we kick out data out of the cache. Maybe it's size-based, right, where it won't hold more than, you know, X number of bytes before it starts kicking out things. But as you're thinking about building up caches in your systems to, again, it's a typical time space trade-off. You're intending to improve CPU efficiency. Be sure you're not, you know, increasing the amount of pressure on the GC by holding on to too much by creating kind of an unbounded leak. And the last thing, this is something that's, again, this is more case study stuff from Roslyn, something we've run into a lot, but it's thread pool starvation. And I can't go into a very detailed explanation if this doesn't mean much to you, but watch out for thread pool starvation when you're using tasks. And you'll know it if you're still making forward progress in your application, but it gets very, very slow. And what happens is that you can have the UI thread blocked on asynchronous work, and the thread pool is full of work, and there's nothing else for it to give a thread. There's no threads to give to that work. And so the thread pool has an algorithm that's tuned pretty good for desktop machines. It was designed originally for server applications in ASP.NET. But it has an algorithm for determining whether it's going to finish work, right, if it's going to make any forward progress on it, and when to go ahead and create a new thread. And generally, that ends up being about once a second it will create a new thread. And so though it's not always easy, the fix here is to always wait, right? So that the thread can be returned back to the thread pool and only continued when the value is there, right? This is kind of one of the core pieces of async. But you can get into cases where you have chains of tasks, and this is where we've seen it in Roslyn, where you have a chain of tasks where all of the asynchronous work is waiting on some other piece of asynchronous work, it's waiting on some other piece of asynchronous work, and it's all looking for the thread pool, and the thread pool is all full. Okay, so it's really hard to detect, but it is something to be aware of, and it's that critical thing of, you know, when you want to spot it, it's that your application is making forward progress, but it's very, very slow. And you can use, there are tools in Visual Studio to kind of try and detect this, like the parallel tasks and parallel stacks windows, but it is very hard to diagnose. So I just wanted to point this out because it's been a kind of a core issue for Roslyn. All right. And so we're nearing the end. So in review, the essential truths. Profiles don't lie, right? So you know, don't guess, right? Don't make hypotheses without a profile. Profiles are not going to lie to you. They're going to point the finger at the problem. Truth number two, the right tool is essential. So, you know, I would recommend Perfue. You can use any profiler at your disposal. Just make sure that it's powerful enough to spot these bottlenecks. And then truth number three is that allocations are king, especially on managed code, especially on high throughput code like Roslyn, that allocations really can harm your responsiveness due to inducing of garbage collections. All right? And so we've come to the end. And so I'm just going to kind of click through some resources. Please evaluate this session. It does make it easier for me to come back in the future if you like the session. And at this point, I want to open it up for questions. There are no microphones, but just raise your hand, and I'll come out. And if you guys want to wait, we can also go to the. You want to ask me a question? I'm going to be at the reception immediately after this. That's in the exhibition hall, and you can meet me up there. So, are there any questions? The question is, running Perfue in a situation where you have IIS, where you're trying to profile an ASP.NET application or something, and does it need to cycle the application pool? The answer is no, because it's not attaching to a process, right? It's collecting events through the event tracing for Windows system, and so it's machine wide, and so no, the answer is you don't have to do that. It'll collect everything. If you're sending out events, it'll collect them. Any other questions? Either I did my job well, or you're all very tired. Yes?
Do you have any false positives using Perfue? So I used profilers for native.
Yes.
Code, and often there were pointed finger at the problem, which was not a problem.
Sure.
So experienced it, do anything?
So the question was, have I experienced any false positives with Perfue, meaning that in native profilers you have seen some false positives in the past where it pointed the finger at something and that was not the problem at all. I have not personally experienced Perfue false positives that it didn't warn me that there might be a false positive, like if a stack was broken or if it was engined images that it didn't have symbols for, or something like that. If I had all the symbols for the code and it was all correct and I was running maybe with what is it called? Com plus zap disable is the registry key. If you set to one, you can launch an application without engining, so it uses the regular images. I haven't seen a false positive. I have seen peeling the onion, right, where it certainly pointed out a bottleneck, but there were deeper bottlenecks underneath it. I have seen that, but I personally haven't seen a false positive from the tool. There are also the cases where you don't have enough instrumentation, for sure, where if you don't have the things instrumented correctly or you're looking for a particular event to fire and you don't actually have it in the application, then you might not see a trigger. But any other questions? Yes? Are we using in Roslyn some non-default GC modes? And you are an advanced bunch, aren't you? The answer is yes. There is a mode coming in .NET 4.5.1, and I'm trying to remember what it's called. but it has to do with turning off. It's a flag that you can set on the GC class that will disable blocking Gen 2 collections for a period of time. And so we use that during typing in Visual Studio right now in Roslyn. So if we have some long-lived objects, we don't want those blocking Gen 2 collections to invade your typing. And so we'll wait till an idle period, and we'll set it back and let those GCs happen. So yes, we are. But we're using it somewhat cleverly, tuned to our application specifically. So I can't remember what it's called, but there is a GC mode that we're trying. Have we seen problems with that? No. No. My understanding is that it was designed for applications that are running, like, for example, stock market sorts of things, where they have machines with, like, unbounded RAM, right? And so they just let them run all day without GCs at all, and then at the end of the day, they just shut them all down and just, okay, all night we'll just collect. So very specialized applications it was introduced for. Yeah. All right. So I think we're about out of time, but one more. Sure.
Does it mean that Visual Studio would be 64 bits or it was 1080p?
Well, that was a big jump. So the question is, Roslyn will run inside of Visual Studio. Does that mean Visual Studio would be 64-bit? That is a big jump of logic, sir. You're assuming that Roslyn is larger than the existing language service in its allocation, which I do not believe it really is. Because one of the things that Roslyn will be doing is replacing the existing language services and the existing language models that we're already building up to drive IntelliSense. And so that memory will be moving out, and Roslyn will move in. There are cases, though, where we are using Roslyn, actually, in Visual Studio 2013. We're using it to drive the code information indicators, the references part of that. And because of that very problem of Visual Studio being a 32-bit process and not wanting to bloat that memory so much. Because as soon as you get, C-sharp in there, and if you had Roslyn in there trying to do this analysis for find all references for that code information indicators, and then say you installed a third-party tool like a ReSharper or a CodeRush or Just Code or any of those tools, and now you've got a third language model going, and Visual Studio just falls over. We wanted to avoid that, and so we actually put it out of process, the analysis for the code information indicators in Visual Studio 2012. Probably pull it in process, though, when we're in the box at some point. So then to take the leap of logic to your ultimate question was, will Visual Studio be 64-bit? And the answer is, not today. So, all right. Thank you very much, guys. I will be